Country Breakfast on RN and I'm Edwina Farley. Regardless of your views on drought aid to farmers, this morning's story can't fail to make you live and breathe, if just a little, what it feels like to watch everything fade away.
I've always been very fond of my sheep and I've always loved breeding better and better sheep. But we've sort of come to that decision now because, adding everything up, I'm 64 years of age. My two children both love the land and the livestock. They've chosen to take other directions. We've decided that it's probably as good a time as any to make the decision to offload them.
What it feels like to sell the sheep after 62 years in the business, a little bit later. But a look at other news first with Brett Worthington. Morning, Brett.
Morning, Edwina.
That story about Murray Goulburn and the ongoing saga around milk prices continues?
Absolutely. It continues with happening with Murray Goulburn. Then you're seeing these ripple effects really start to spread out. So as most people would have heard, Murray Goulburn, Australia's largest dairy processor, which we talked about last week, slashed its prices a couple of weeks ago. So farmers are now earning quite a lot less and it's a retrospective cut. And you've also seen other processors follow through. One of the issues that farmers have been talking about is that they feel they were quite shocked and it was quite a sudden write-down. And so now the dairy processor Murray Goulburn has confirmed that the corporate regulator ASIC has made inquiries into the company. It's all to do with what happened on February 29. So that's when the company released its half-yearly results. And that saw a profit downgrade of what the company was predicting from back when it floated at the start of July. You then, in the months that followed, you saw the sudden trading halt and then the announcement that the profit forecast was down even further and that the prices that dairy farmers would be receiving would be cut as well. The chairman is Philip Tracy, and he says despite everything that's going on, the board is adamant it's made all the right decisions.
We will cooperate fully with any investigation. We expect regulators to pay attention whenever a PDS is, if you miss a PDS forecast. We're very comfortable that the decisions we've made, when we've made them and how we've disclosed them.
I mean, you've seen a third member of the board resign now. So Western Victorian dairy farmer Duncan Morris, he was a member of the Finance, Risk and Audit Committee. He said that his resignation is to spend more time working on his own accountancy practice and also spend more time on his dairy farm. So now at the moment you're seeing that when the board meets later this year, it will have three more director positions come up and they're your supplier position. So you have to be supplying milk to the cooperative, which is what Murray Goulburn largely is, to go for one of those positions.
It hasn't been a completely blot-free copybook either over the years for Murray Goulburn. They've had a number of issues at board, director and management level. And of course, being a federal election campaign, the politicians are also deciding that this is a good one to get involved in.
It feels as though you've had a slight delay in what the response has been. So initially there was some talk from politicians, but now the further we get from the initial write down, you're seeing more and more enter into this space. Labor's Joel Fitzgibbon was actually in Colac this week. He's the ALP's agricultural spokesman and he was meeting with dairy farmers down there. He's been quite critical of the government and he says that the ALP is working on its own policy at the moment to deal with a potential support package for farmers, although when pressed on exact policies, no details were put forward. Like I was saying, he has been critical of the Agriculture Minister, Barnaby Joyce. He says, he's hit back at Mr. Fitzgibbon's suggestions. He says he's going to be in Victoria next week, and when he's there, he will talk with farmers, and work out what the government role is going forward.
And it's a really complex conversation in Victoria because there are sort of splinter groups out from the major Victorian dairy farming group, the UDV. There are other kind of rowdier groups running their own line. There's sort of talk about, was deregulation a good thing? Should there be a floor price? And then other people going, oh my God, what a nightmare. Let's not go back to that particular place. We've emerged from it. So it's incredibly complex.
But because that group, Farmer Power, arranged a meeting during the week and they had 500 farmers go to Southwest Victoria. They met in Terang and they had a big session. But one of the slight issues was that there was quite a bit of bickering between the lobby groups. And essentially, there was no united decision put forward as to how the farmers would respond to this. And I guess that goes to the point of what Barnaby Joyce has been saying, is that he's now waiting for the farmers and industries to decide what they actually want before working out if government would have a role.
And you mentioned Fonterra, another milk processor as well, also looked at its prices this week.
Yeah, so Lion Dairy and Drinks, it's followed Murray Goulburn and cut its prices. Although the impact of this one is slightly different. Where Fonterra and Murray Goulburn made a retrospective cut, so basically farmers are now earning quite a lot less to kind of compensate for being overpaid, for Lion, the change is only for the month of June. So they're going to drop their prices down. And it will only affect about 10% of Lion's suppliers, because most of them are on fixed contracts, whether it's over a 1 year fixed price or over three, as some are. So I think it's about 10% of the company's suppliers are on this. Phil Beatty is a spokesperson for the collective bargaining group with Lion in Tasmania, and he says he's actually relieved that the cut wasn't more severe.
It had a connection to the Fonterra price, so Lion would, in theory, have been within their rights to drop the price significantly for May and June, as Fonterra have. But those people who chose to have a variable price will make a difference to their milk price, but only in June.
And for people that are listening, we should kind of clarify the major processes that we're talking about, Murray Goulburn and Fonterra. The majority of their product goes into export markets. It's not the milk you drink in the supermarket.
And that's why they're saying they had to cut prices. They're saying the Australian dollar had an impact, and then the consumption of adult milk powder in China has dropped off quite substantially, and that's where a lot of this market is going. You've seen that's why Fonterra has cut prices to suppliers in New Zealand. They're much more at the whim of the global market there because they're producing so much more in this powder space, so much so that some in New Zealand are saying they need to build no more dehydrators and look to fresh markets as a way, because fresh will hold its price in a way that you're not seeing the fluctuations globally. And that's why you've seen some northern New South Wales milk producers come out and say they're hopeful that they'll be quite insulated from what's happening with the Murray Goulburn cuts. In northern New South Wales, around Upper Manila, which is north of Tamworth, Rob Cooper's a farmer there, and he has a Murray Goulburn contract, but he feels that this will be dealt with differently because he's supplying a fresh product to Queensland where there's ongoing shortages.
But we're not sure of the full effect of that price drop, but we are in a different market here because we're providing whole milk into both Sydney and Brisbane and the New South Wales, Queensland states. So, yeah, our price is more reflected on what we can get in the whole milk market.
Now, away from dairy stories and having a look at bit of a peculiar circumstance, really, for Victorian farmers who are making use of some of those federal funds for drought assistance.
It's quite a complicated space. So that's one of the key policies that the government has put forward. Both sides of Parliament have gone forward with this drought concessional loans program. There was a second round of funding made available to Victorian farmers, and it seems that about 90% of those funds that were set aside haven't been allocated. And if then the money isn't allocated by the end of the financial year, so we're talking about $30 million in total, would go back to the government if they don't approve a drought loan. So there's only been about $2 million worth that's been approved. The member for Mallee, Andrew Broad, he's a Nationals backbencher. He says that, well, essentially it's working because you're making banks are becoming more competitive in this space, and they're stepping in, and that, you know, it's great that people don't have to rely on a government loan. But obviously, I think there are some farmers, particularly on that Victorian South Australian border, that say they have an issue with the way the policy is structured, and that it's too restrictive and it makes it too hard for people to get access to these loans to then utilise them.
Meanwhile, another part of that drought assistance package, which was relating to financial counselling, there are some real concerns around that.
Well, Wimmera Uniting Care is the group that's given the money to run the program in Western Victoria. It was given $485,000 to a targeted mental health program in five shires. But the chief executive, Wendy Sturgis, says the funding wasn't made available until January. It came with 6 months to use it, and they still had to recruit all the workers to run the program.
Asking someone to step into a role for 6 months, a role that requires such a high level of trust building and engagement skills and credibility building, it's a pretty big ask. The 6 month funding is an absolute limitation. And really, it's not a great return on investment from the government's point of view.
Well, they're also still having a difficult time in Queensland. It's a fourth failed wet season.
That's right. In a second, we'll talk about some of the rain that we saw this week and the benefit that it had. But the Queensland Parliament, the Agriculture Minister, Leanne Donaldson, got up and delivered the drought statement. She said that 83.9% of the state was still in drought. I mean, it's slightly down. The record high was 86.1%. last year. So since the last statement, you've seen three shires be removed from the list, but you've had another two added onto it. And it's something that I guess that the Queensland government is currently trying to work with. The Agriculture Minister, Leanne Donaldson, says that the statement is built around what local communities and committees are telling her.
It's not just one element that they take into account. And, you know, this committee is made up of local graziers who are passionate. You know, they're local pastoralists, they know the land, they know, you know, what their shire is like. So I have no reason to not accept their expert recommendations to me.
It really is a tale of two countries because it's been the polar opposite in the southeast.
Well, farmers in the southern and western parts of New South Wales got some soaking rain last weekend. Some of the falls, there was more than 100 millimetres in some parts of the high country. But down in the cropping districts, you were seeing more than 50 millimetres, which was great after it being such a prolonged dry period. It actually brought a smile to Geordie Forster. He'd been out hand-feeding cattle and sheep when the rain near Gundagai was falling, and he was really hoping that that would inject some life into the livestock markets.
It gives everyone a lot of confidence, this rain, that does, and I think the cattle market will probably bounce a bit with this. I'm not so sure about the sheep market. It's been nice and steady for a long time, but I think it just allows you to plan ahead and prepare for what's coming for the next 12 months.
Victoria was similarly lucky.
Yeah, that's right. So some of these struggling dairy farmers that have been dealing with price cuts, they did get some rain at the weekend and early into the week. So somewhere between 30 and 150 millimetres fell. And why it was great was because you've got this high irrigation water costs at the moment and then the dry conditions. So you're seeing that compounding effect there. Alistair Gibson is a dairy farmer near Rochester. And he said, if nothing else, it was a bit of a boost for mental health of many of the farmers.
Put a bit of a spring in the step. We were dragging our heels fairly well for the last week or two, but it's taken a bit of pressure off. Well, the glass is not half full, it's a quarter full, but gotta start somewhere, I guess.
The eternal optimism. I just love that idea. It's not half full, it's a quarter full.
Quarter full.
But it's still full, not empty.
It's empty in the Wimmera, apparently.
Oh, it was the saddest part of last weekend, if I'm honest. So Jonathan Dyer, we'll hear from him in a second, he tweeted a photo and it showed the rain band moving across from South Australia into Victoria. And picture a donut. And in the centre of the donut was large parts of Western Victoria, and the rain was just falling everywhere else around them. Jonathan Dyer was saying they were forecasted 20 millimetres where he was, but only got two.
Friday, Saturday night, it was almost like harvest time with the amount of headlights going around. People seeding in anticipation, getting crops in, hoping for a big rain to bring them up.
Thankfully, though, they did get a bit of the other rain that was to fall later in the week. I think they will take whatever they can get at the moment, particularly with crops in the ground, and they're keen to get them going.
Absolutely. We want more of it. Who knows? Isn't it the saying that when the pollies visit that the rain comes with them sometimes?
Well, the winter campaign could time nicely. maybe they could have another campaign just before harvest for a bit of a late spring break. So that would really kind of turn the fortunes around.
Brett, I couldn't survive two campaigns in one year. Thank you very much.
I think we'd be leaving the country.
That's right. Thank you, Brett.
Thank you.
Don't forget, all those stories are online, including our special feature looking at the finances of Murray Goulburn, abc.net.au/rural.
Animal rights, should they be formally recognised?
We are the all-powerful, omnipresent, sentient beings on the planet. We are the ones that hold their lives in our hands, and that's why we have the responsibility.
Animal rights are not the way to look after animals. We all want to look after animals.
Animal rights should trump human interests. It's the latest Intelligence Squared debate, and you can hear it on Big Ideas with me, Paul Barclay, online anytime at the RN website.
You're with RN and A Country Breakfast. Let's join our rural reporters. This week, scientists and anglers join forces to help save an endangered fish. We muck in at a junior cattle handling course and find out what to do with feijoas. Apparently, New Zealanders just love to eat them, but we Aussies don't know what to do with the fruit. And talking of food, we'll meet a former bureaucrat turned baker, John Rose, who now spends his days tending a wood-fired oven, turning out tasty sourdough loaves.
I mean, you can buy bread now in a shop or a supermarket that has hardly ever been touched by a human hand. That's a remarkable technological achievement, but as far as my customers are concerned, it's lost something. Mainly flavour, taste and goodness.
We'll be firing up that old Scotch oven in the New South Wales town of Adelong a bit later in the show. But first up today, let's pull on those waders and help save a fish.
So Macquarie perch were hugely abundant species, particularly in the slopes and upland regions, and probably the most abundant fish in those sort of areas. And now are obviously listed as endangered and are very rare. There's only 5 populations left in New South Wales. So they're really in danger of becoming extinct and locally extinct, as they have done in many other areas, including the Macquarie catchment, where they got their name from. So there's no longer any Macquarie perch within the Macquarie catchment. And so we're trying to stop them becoming locally extinct in some of these other catchments as well.
The name of this spot really says it all. We're on a stretch of the Retreat River in the Abercrombie National Park near Oberon in the central west of New South Wales. Hello, I'm Melanie Pearce, and it's here that Luke Pearce and the team from the Macquarie Perch Refuge Project hopes to save a fish species. They've retreated to the Retreat River to set up a safe haven, a sort of Noah's Ark to breed up populations of the endangered Macquarie perch, safely isolated from the introduced predator fish, the European redfin perch, and the deadly virus it carries.
These fish have been released here to protect them from the redfin perch, which is an invasive introduced species, which is a highly predatory species and has been shown to have really significant impacts on Macquarie perch populations. And they've only recently invaded the Abercrombie catchment, which is where this river flows into, and potentially could wipe out the native population in that river itself. So we've tried to establish a population in this Retreat River, which is above a set of waterfalls that the redfin won't be able to swim up, and so therefore this population, if we can establish it, should be safe from the impacts of those redfin. So it's sort of a refuge population, kind of like a Noah's Ark we're trying to establish to try and save this species from the impacts of redfin potentially could have on the population in the Abercrombie River.
The Macquarie Perch Refuge Project goes back to 2008, when scientists first drew up the battle plan to save the fish. They gathered specimens from the Abercrombie River and took them to the Department of Primary Industries Fisheries Research Centre in Narrandra to set up a captive breeding program. Luke Pearce and the team are keen to discover if their sanctuary project is working and the fingerlings they released into the Retreat River 5 years ago are successfully breeding up new generations of Macquarie perch.
The fish that we started breeding from were originally collected in 2008, and we started and they weren't mature fish, so we had to wait a couple of years before they actually reached sexual maturity, and then we've been breeding from those for a number of years now, and we've actually had 3 stockings of this particular site, so I've had 3 successful breeding events. And that's quite unique because Macquarie perch have historically been very difficult to breed in a captive environment, so hopefully now that those fish that we've stocked in here have reached sexual maturity, we'll try and establish if they're actually breeding in their new environment. So we're trying today to hopefully catch some juveniles or some young of the year fish that, you know, have hopefully been bred here in the wild. So if we catch fish that are smaller or younger than the fish that we've actually stocked in here, then we know we're starting to they're successfully breeding, which is the next step in the sort of process of establishing a population here.
Describe this process that you've got. So you've got big electric packs on your back and long poles with nets and rings on the end. What is this equipment?
Yeah, so basically what we're using here today to sample the fish, well, one of the methods we're using is called an electrofisher, a backpack electrofisher. So we've got a backpack on that contains some batteries and a transformer and like you said, a long pole with a ring on it, which is the anode, and then a long wire tail, which is the cathode. And they sort of are a bit like the two ends of a battery, I suppose. And what happens is an electric current passes from one to the other and sets up an electric field around each of those bits of metal, and then if the fish swim into that or we pass that that apparatus near the fish, then they actually get an electric current through their body, which immobilises them and allows us to net them and capture them while they're stunned, and then actually measure them and weigh them and record what we catch, and then they recover and we let them go back into where we caught them again from.
You want a bigger bucket?
The Macquarie Perch Refuge Project brings together staff from DPI Fisheries, the National Park Service, and some very proactive local angling groups who are keen to see this native fish back in its natural environment.
I'm Cole Gordon, Vice President of the Sofala Branch of CAS. I suppose I first started fishing out in this area in the mid-70s.
Did you used to catch and see a lot of Macquarie perch in those times?
They used to be quite frequent in our catches, yeah. They weren't as abundant as the trout used to be, but most definitely you'd always encounter Macquarie perch in or you're fishing for trout, yeah.
When did you become aware that there was a bit of a problem, though, or they were getting endangered?
When you go out and you consistently don't catch them or don't see them, yeah. So you sort of know there's something's been going on.
What made you want to help preserve these fish?
Well, I think it's just something we owe a younger generation. Like, we don't want to see anything that's extinct. You know, like if it was koala bears or kookaburras or things like that, they'd be a lot more noticeable, whereas fish are less noticeable to most people.
Do you think fishermen like yourself who've been fishing for long times, decades, perhaps even generations, might help in alerting scientists to the health of these rivers and the fish stocks in them?
Most definitely. That's what we hope to do. It's generally the fishermen are the first people to notice changes in the environment that they locally fish in. Yeah, and then I guess the next step is then to actually be able to contact the right people that will take notice of you.
How significant do you think it is that all these groups are working together, national parks, we're in at the Abercrombie National Park at the moment, Department of Primary Industries, Fisheries, and of course, on the ground, volunteer fishers working together?
Yeah, I think it is significant. Like, it's the only way we're going to go forward. DPI have got the scientific knowledge. The parks actually control what goes on within the park. And I guess from our point of view, from an angling point of view, it's great to see, you know, the species continue to thrive in the areas where they should be.
After 3 days of sampling, the team recorded 15 Macquarie perch in this stretch of the Retreat River, the largest of which was 35 centimetres long, but unfortunately none of the juvenile fish they were hoping to find. They think low water levels could be a contributing factor.
It really is a unique taste. The first thing that you meet is the aroma, the smell of the fruit. It's not overpowering, but it's a bit perfumey, and it's definitely a bit different. 2% of the world are put off them because of that. 98% of them join the queue to buy the fruit.
If you're a New Zealander, then you probably know all about feijoas. They're a favourite to eat. But to most Australians, they're still a relatively unknown winter fruit. They're about the size of a kiwi fruit, but smoother. And the flower itself is also edible, with gorgeous deep pink petals. I'm told they're delicious in a glass of champagne. Hello, I'm Margot Kelly. I'm at a small feijoa orchard near Kindred in northwest Tasmania. It's here that an enterprising couple are doing their bit to spread the word about this native South American fruit and encourage others to grow them, taking advantage of Tasmania's ideal rich soils, climate, and all-important fruit fly-free status.
Hi, I'm Christine Earthroll from Kindred Feijoas.
And I'm John Earthroll, and neither of us are horticulturalists.
You've ended up with feijoas by accident, didn't you?
We did, yes. When we came down from Northern Territory, we really loved the property. So it happened to have 95 feijoa trees on, so we had a very fast learning curve to find out what we could do with them and what they were.
It seems like the answer to that question is quite a bit, because we're at the farm gate right now and there's an awful lot of different jars, different value-added products here. Can you talk me through what we're looking at?
At the moment, we're inside the farm gate, and there are jams and chutneys made with the feijoas and some of our other veggies that and fruit that we grow on the farm. There's also some wine up on the top and a couple that John have experimented with wine. And in the freezer, there's some ice cream.
So how have you found people's responsiveness to, first of all, let's talk about the fruit. You've been going for a little while. Have people come around to the idea of what a feijoa is and they like it?
Slowly they are, yes. We found it a bit of a struggle in the beginning because people didn't really know the fruit. But a lot of people are willing to try it, and that usually sells people too. We also had testers for the jams and chutney so they could find out what it's like when it's cooked and preserved. People either really like them or they don't like them. They really like the taste. I think one issue is they need to wait until they're really ripe to try them, because like all fruit, if you eat it when it's green, it is quite acidic. So, yeah.
We must stress that we are not a major producer. We bought this property as a retirement place to go fishing and so on. I think I've been fishing twice in 5 years. The other important thing, Margot, is that a lot of people grow Fijoa trees in their gardens. And until we came along and showed them what to do with them, one, they didn't know what they were, and two, they now know how to eat them.
I have to confess that I've eaten a Fijoa before, but I walk past a Fijoa tree almost every day without knowing what that strange fruit is.
Yes, that's what we found at markets as well. People aren't really sure, and they were letting the fruit drop to the ground and didn't know what to do with it, so they'd kind of sweep it up or they'd throw it next door to the cows or something like that, not knowing that it was something that was very good for them.
And you can turn it into a chutney.
You can turn it into a chutney or a jam, or and eating them fresh is beautiful for you too.
The Fijoas grow on a shrubby bush, with the fruit ready to harvest between May and late July. John and Christine Earthroll need to keep a close eye on the orchard if wild weather is on its way.
It's a worry if we get storms and hail and rain and snow sometimes in the winter, as the fruit then tends to drop. We don't pick the fruit. We wait for the fruit to drop off the tree. And as you will see underneath the trees, there is a straw bed to cushion the fall. And myself and our little dog, Harry, irrespective of the weather, we have to be out there every morning and picking up Fijoas.
Can we go and take a look?
Yes.
Come on, Harry, we're going to show Margo where things are.
There's one here.
There's one here, you can see all the fruit forming.
So what do the fruit look like?
Well, we think we have seven varieties here in the 96 tree orchard, based on the book we purchased from New Zealand. There's no book published in Australia on the subject. Some of them are only 15, 20 millimetres. Some of them are 10 centimetres long. These are different varieties from the same orchard.
They're similar size to a kiwi fruit, I often say to people, and they're smooth, green-skinned, and they remain green throughout their lives. They haven't got a furry skin like kiwi fruit, but you cut them open in the same way and scoop them out if you wish to eat them fresh.
And a few years ago, we were at a market, and a New Zealander quietly came up to us, watching us demonstrate to someone how to eat Fijoas by cutting them in half and spooning them up. And he said, "You don't do it like that." And he grabbed a Fijoa and just ate the whole thing like an apple, which is the way New Zealanders do it.
Eating a Fijoa the Kiwi way, John and Christine Earthroll speaking with our reporter Margot Kelly at their farm at Kindred in northwest Tasmania. Still to come today, we're firing up an 1880s wood-fired oven to bake some bread, and kids spend their school holidays mucking in at a junior cattle handler's workshop.
My name's Kelly Manning and I'm from Mardella. This is about my sixth camp. It's just so friendly orientated, and you learn lots, meet good people.
And what would you say to the average city kid who's on school holidays now, sitting, you know, at home watching telly, playing with an iPhone or something? This looks like a lot of fun.
Come and try it. Might like it.
Well, some kids might spend their school holidays glued to their screens and smartphones. West Australia's next generation of beef producers have had their hands full at a junior cattle handler's course. Hello, I'm Anthony Pansia at the Brunswick Showgrounds in the southwest corner of the state. More than 100 young people have settled in with their stud animals for a three-day camp. Some are here for the first time, others are regulars, but they're all keen to learn more about their cattle and the industry they want to be involved in.
Yeah, my name's Lachlan Fry. I'm the chairman of the WA Youth Cattle Handlers Camp, and basically it's showcasing for the young people of the industry, an opportunity to learn new skills about the cattle industry, and hopefully show that enthusiasm to want to be a part of the agriculture industry in the future. I guess that's what we're trying to do, really help develop that passion and nurture them so that they're going to hang around in our industry, which I think is a really important thing to do. And I guess at the end of the day, we're just really trying to encourage these young people to keep an interest in the cattle industry and be a part of ag in the future. That's our main priority. So they'll learn about structure of an animal, what makes up a good animal structure wise. They learn a little bit about junior judging, how to judge an animal, how to parade an animal in the show ring. But also very targeting the commercial side of it as well. And
it also looks like it's going to be a very hands-on 3 days. So should we go and get hands-on, or?
Sure, we can go and have a look, for sure.
Your name is?
Amanda Kavanagh Quilty.
And so why have you come here?
I've come to learn more about my cows because I'm very interested in agriculture and I'd like a future for when I'm older. This is my fourth camp that I've been to, so I've been to a few now.
What do you enjoy doing at the camps?
Well, you learn so many different skills, like how to tie knots, but my favourite is probably the competition at the end of the camp.
Competition in?
Leading them. So, like, walking around and showing the judge your attention and how well you can handle the animal. Yeah, it's a great atmosphere to be around and so much better than being in the city. Yeah.
Jake.
Where are you from, Jake?
I'm from Capel.
And how old are you?
I am 8.
I saw you sort of mucking around with the straw here. What are you doing here? What's this little job?
We're making the cow's beds.
That's pretty exciting. How do you make a cow's bed?
You get some straw and you just spread it around until it's flat and fluffy.
It looks pretty comfortable.
Not really.
Is this where the kids are also sleeping tonight? Or?
No, just the cows.
All right, boys, we're looking at a couple of cows. These are your cows too, I understand.
Yes, they are.
What can you tell us about them? Perhaps most importantly, what are their names?
This is Kaleidoscope and the other one's Lucky.
What breed of cow is that?
Charolais.
Was he right?
Yes.
So what can you tell us about these two?
They're very quiet and they're very good, structured and all of that stuff.
Do they also feel like pets to you as well?
Yes, very much so.
And you've got a few more of these back home too?
Yes, we've got 1,000?
No. 1,000?
Maybe. 700.
Have you known them their whole life?
I've known her all my life.
So you would have been there when it was born?
Yes.
Lachlan, just based on that little conversation, they've got a fair bit of knowledge already.
Yeah, they certainly do. And I guess this is another great opportunity for them to be able to further their knowledge. You know, obviously they've learned a bit from their parents or people that they might work for. But again, this is just, you know, to help polish them off and learn those extra things. And as we heard before, you know, some of these kids, it's their fourth camp and they just want to keep coming back and learning more and gaining more and more knowledge. And I think that's fantastic and it's a great thing for the industry.
It's a massive structure. It has very thick walls. It has 2 tonnes of sand below, 2 tonnes of sand above, so that the oven itself is forms of thermal mass.
They used to be found in towns across country Australia, enormous Scotch ovens that used radiant heat to cook the bread. Most fell into disrepair with the advent of mass-produced industrial-sized bakeries, but some like this one at Adelong in southern New South Wales are firing up again thanks to people like John Rose. John used to be a senior bureaucrat living in Sydney, but now you find him and his wife, Jane, up to their elbows in dough in this small country town.
When I light a fire in my firebox for this oven, and from zero temperature, I need to run the oven for about 3 days to build a quantity of heat into that oven, into those bricks and into that sand. Then when I close that fire down, ready for baking, that heat will come back into my baking chamber. And as I load bread and unload bread and I lose heat from the oven, that heat will come back out of the bricks and back out of the sand to keep it, the baking chamber, at a baking temperature.
And the sand is also what holding the heat in as you are baking at the time.
Yeah. It absorbs the heat from my fire and then feeds that heat back in when I kill the fire to bake my bread. So I have no fire going when I bake my bread.
Hello, I'm Michael Kavner. John and Jane Rose have put a lot of work into restoring this Scotch oven to its former glory. When they first came to Adelong, it was covered in blue acrylic paint. But now the bakery is very much back in business, with John and Jane selling their signature Stella Rossa sourdough loaves at farmers markets in the district.
This style of Scotch oven that was built from about the 1870s to the 1930s, all very similar, a very straightforward design to A, hold the heat in its thermal mass, and B, to create a baking chamber that could do up to 300 loaves at a time. Every small town had a bakery. Some medium-sized towns would have had 2 or 3 of these. And they survived right through to the 1930s, but when industrial baking took over, the large baking conglomerates, one way or another, conspired to either destroy or put out of commission most of these. And so it's why it's more common to find them now surviving in small towns, which tended to be off the radar for the large industrials.
So let's have a look at the oven itself.
What you can see right in the middle of it is quite a small cast iron door.
Yeah, given the size of the entire structure, the door itself would be less than a metre square, but the brickwork is quite substantial. Now you look into it, we've got bricks that are quite flat, but there's not much room from the ceiling of the oven through to the floor.
The good thing about that is that you don't need a lot of height for your bread. The higher it goes, the harder it is to heat that space. So you actually want quite a low domed area to preserve two things. One, obviously, is heat, but the other is when you load your bread, the bread lets off steam. And it's the steam that helps give the bread that oven kick that people are looking for. So it goes in the dough a little bit flat, but with the right heat and the right amount of steam, it puffs up into a beautiful high loaf. On the right-hand side, we have our firebox. It's like your normal wood-burning stove at home, I guess.
Except it's not that large, actually. Well, it's not enormous. It does go back fairly deep.
Yeah. So I get good wood, like a stringy bark or a box in there, and I build that up quite high. So the flames are roaring into my baking chamber.
At the same time, heating the sand.
Exactly right. Heating the bricks and the sand. And my flue is on the opposite side to the firebox. So the flames and the heat have to travel from the right-hand side through my baking chamber to the flue on the left-hand side, where the smoke and ash goes up the chimney. As that heat is circulating through from my firebox to the opposite side to my flue, that's heating all those bricks, the floor of the baking chamber, which is also bricks, and the sand above and below. It's the radiant heat that matters. 2 hours before I bake, I close my firebox doors and that fire goes out. 2 hours later, I will then give a nice thorough mop with a wet mop to that hot hearth in the baking chamber, which serves two purposes. It cleans any ash that's come out of the fire and evens out any hot spots of temperature. When that's done, I can then load my bread.
Is there a difference in the bread you make using this oven to if you had installed a commercial operation?
Two things. There are people that claim that they can taste the difference in an oven that's been heated naturally with that radiant heat. That's what some people say. But I also say that the entire process that I'm forcing myself to go through in hand shaping all my bread, hand loading it into an oven that's been fired by wood that I cut and loaded myself, is a part of the process of putting something into that bread that otherwise wouldn't be there.
And very different to the commercial line of bread, which in a way played a part in the demise of these sort of ovens.
Yes, I mean, you can buy bread now in a shop or a supermarket that has hardly ever been touched by a human hand. That's a remarkable technological achievement, but as far as my customers are concerned, it's lost something. Mainly flavour, taste and goodness.
Breadmaker John Rose turning out some fabulous loaves from the old Scotch oven in Adelong in southern New South Wales. I'm Edwina Farley, you're with a Country Breakfast this morning on RN. Well, the charm of station life can be pretty addictive, and whole generations of Australians have grown up knowing what it's like to work and live, prosper and struggle through the cycles of farming. This morning, a very personal story about what it's like to watch that legacy wither and to make the tough decision to pull up stumps.
Hey, you want to hear about the best party in town this election season? It's a new podcast with me, Frank Kelly.
And me, Patricia Carvelis.
It's called The Party Room.
We'll get together to make sense of one of the longest election campaigns in history.
The best moments and maybe the worst.
Hear from Australia's sharpest political minds.
It's your essential guide to this federal election.
And the odd bit of singing.
If you're lucky, subscribe now. Simply search for The Party Room in your podcast app.
Or listen via the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.
Imagine watching the slow meltdown of your business as one by one the sheep, the assets and the profits dripped away over 4 years. That's how it's been for Western Queensland grazier Pat Hegarty, who has lived and worked at his property, Kalania Station, since 1954. He told our reporter Lydia Burton they've tried everything, right up to the last.
We've been in pretty severe drought now since 2013. Beginning of 2013, we were fully stocked with 9,500 sheep and Unfortunately, it didn't rain very much at all in 2013. We only had 63 mil for the whole year, and consequently we started selling down then, and basically been progressively selling down since then. And we fed our remaining sheep for 8 months, every day of the week for 8 months, our breeders, and we chose to join those breeders, and they tried to lamb out in August, September, so that was a big job, and a bit of a disaster, I have to admit, but we did feed a lot of feed to them last year, and fed right up until January, hoping that it would rain this summer, and unfortunately it hasn't, so we're in a pretty bad way at the moment. It's basically severe drought here at present.
Have you ever seen a drought like it before?
No, I haven't, and it's the driest period I've ever seen. Driest extended period I've probably ever seen. I know there's always been dry times in the 70s and 60s and the 80s, but we always seem to get some sort of summer rain that would run water into dams and that kind of thing, but the last few years we haven't even had enough rain to fill dams, which is disappointing. So, yeah, it's certainly the driest I've seen it at this area west of Longreach.
Why did you make that decision to feed, and why did you say that it was a bit of a disaster?
I always like to think that I've been a positive person and always wanted to be positive with my breeding program with our sheep. And I chose to join them last year. We didn't have a lot of rain at the beginning of the year, and I always joined in March, and I did. I thought surely it's got to rain March, April, and of course it didn't. And then once those ewes are pregnant, you have the choice to either sell them or feed them. And at that stage, I decided that I wanted to try and hang on to my best breeders for another year and hope that the drought would break. So once they were pregnant, we then had to embark on a fairly extensive feeding program to get them through that. And we virtually had no grass. We virtually fed them hay and a lot of corn and a lot of dry lick to get them through that. But it doesn't matter how much money or feed you throw at those animals, there's no substitute for grass. And also the fact that we were feeding every day, constantly every day. The lambs, you know, were abandoned all the time because Mum was hungry and she'd just come running for the feed each time. So we only ended up with about 36% of lambs last year, which I consider a disaster. And that was basically because we just had no feed and we were feeding them and they just come running all the time for the feed and abandoning the lambs. You know, hunger takes over from motherhood when things get that bad.
In saying that though, Pat, walking around the yards today, the sheep look in amazing condition. You're pretty happy with how they've come out of this drought?
Yes, Lydia, I am. We're currently shearing, as you know, and I'm very pleasantly surprised with their condition. We're now sort of planning to sell those ewes off, and we're just fortunate that they are in pretty good condition, a very good condition really, considering, you know, what they've been through in the last 3 to 4 years.
And so you're selling all of those sheep in the next few weeks?
Yes, Lydia, that's correct. We've decided to, we've had a discussion as a family, and we've decided now to offload all those ewes. We've got about 900 flock ewes remaining and our 400 stud ewes, and we've decided to sell the lot simply because we're at the point now where we just don't have any spare cash left to feed them. In previous years we've had stock to sell off to finance the feeding program for our ewes, but now we don't have anything to sell, only those ewes, and I don't want to get in a corner where I'm forced to borrow money to feed the stock. So I just think that's an economic disaster to be borrowing money to feed stock, particularly as there's no sort of light at the end of the tunnel with regards to the weather. So we've chosen to offload them while they're still in good condition and hopefully worth some handy money, and then just get out of this problem that we're in at the moment and not be in a position where we have to borrow funds to carry on.
How hard was coming to that decision that you're completely going to destock?
Yeah, no, it hasn't been easy. I've always been very fond of my sheep, and I've always loved breeding better and better sheep. But we've sort of come to that decision now because, you know, adding everything up, I'm 64 years of age. My two children both love the land and the livestock, but they've chosen to take other directions where they can have a guaranteed income. And I don't blame them for that. So sort of adding all those things up, we've decided that it's probably as good a time as any to make the decision to offload them. You know, we could battle on for another couple of years and still be in the same position next year, and then having borrowed money to carry those ewes through. So we think we're sort of quitting while we're ahead a little bit and in control of the situation. But as I said, Lydia, it wasn't easy, but I'd like to think that we're making the right decision.
What's next for the Hegarty family?
Yeah, a bit unsure with that one, Lydia, but I think ultimately we'll sell off the property down the track, and if we have to wait for good rain to do that, that's what we'll do.
Was this always part of the plan, Pat, or do you feel like you're heading into retirement a bit earlier than you originally thought?
Probably a little bit earlier than we originally thought. We've been through the succession thing with our children, and you know, we were sort of planning to get out by the time I was 65, 66, somewhere around there, and I'm getting very close to that. But, you know, the drought has probably forced the decision on us a little bit more. Had we been fully stocked with a good mob of sheep that we had 4 years ago, it would have been a lot easier maybe for one of the children to take it over. But now we're in that position where it's very difficult for them to do it, and they've seen what Susan and I have been through with it, and they've just decided, you know, they've both got good jobs and they want to have that security of a good, secure income for them and their families, and I can understand that. So, yeah, it is a little bit earlier than we probably would have planned, but let's hope it's the right decision.
How long have you been at Calanya for?
We've been here since 1954. My father drew this block in a ballot in 1954. And we've sort of progressed ever since then. My father passed away in 1979. I've been running the show ever since then. It's a good little property. It's been good to us all those years. But sooner or later, you have to have rain on it to keep it going. And we just, you know, I don't know, the rain seems to be becoming a bit more unreliable. So we've decided to, you know, that 4 years is enough. We've been feeding on and off now for 4 years and selling down now. And we've got to that point where we think it's probably time to hopefully quit while we're ahead.
What are some of your fondest and some of your favourite memories that you'll take away from Calanya?
Some of my favourite memories obviously are seeing my kids grow up here and working with them. They really enjoyed working on the land and the livestock, but also I've enjoyed seeing the property progress over the years. You know, we've gone from positions back in the 70s where we were marking 47% of lambs. And sort of in recent years, 10, 11 and 12, we were averaging well over 100% of lambs, and I got a hell of a kick out of that. To see the place sort of go forward all the time and that kind of thing. So, yeah, that's definitely one of the highlights.
Oh, it's a little bit heartbreaking and a bit hard for a Saturday morning, but it's a very worthwhile story. Pat Hegarty from Calanya Station in Western Queensland, chatting there with our rural reporter Lydia Burton. Now, how would you fancy drinking 100-day-old fresh milk? It's something made possible thanks to a Melbourne-based company which has developed technology that extends the product's shelf life so it can be exported by boat. Those exports are worth $2 million a year in a deal to supply fresh milk to Malaysia. Our reporter Clint Jasper visited the plant to find out more.
For the last 10 years, three schoolmates have been making and processing cold-pressed juices, milk-based protein drinks and coconut water at their facility in Scoresby in Melbourne's southeast. Now, after a decade in business, they've struck a deal with retailers in Malaysia. Exporting fresh milk overseas is made possible by specialised processing technology. Company co-founder Luke Marguette explained to me how it works.
So over the last few years, we've invested around $20 million at our facility in Melbourne. Part of the processing technology we have here is ultra clean technology, and what that enables us to do is extend the shelf life of fresh beverages such as juice and dairy, where typically with a dairy product you would achieve around 20 days shelf life. We can achieve up to 100 days shelf life with fresh dairy.
And is that like just a better pasteurisation process?
So it involves a range of equipment and different processes that give us that extended shelf life. So, for example, we blow mould our own PET bottles, our plastic bottles here on site, which means coming into the filling room, we have sterile bottles. So we have very clean packaging. We also process at a slightly higher temperature than regular fresh milk, but significantly below the temperatures that would be achieved in UHT production.
What is this deal with Malaysia worth to your company?
It's a massive win for the business. We just celebrated our 10th birthday, And in the past, I guess it's been a real, you know, challenge building the business from scratch to really achieve the success that we have in Australia. And so we're really excited about this win and really what it means to the business is, you know, a launching pad into our new export. We have some great products, some great processing technologies, and we think we're really set to win offshore.
Where will your milk be appearing on the shelves in Malaysia, and who are you dealing with overseas to get it through those supply chains?
So the specific Malaysian milk arrangement that we have that's launching shortly is us supplying our extended shelf life fresh milk to a company, a dairy business in Malaysia, who has quite a broad distribution. So they'll be reaching their consumers through more higher-end convenience and grocery stores, where there's a slight more affluent consumer that has the ability to be able to purchase a fresh milk product that would be higher cost to alternative products such as UHT.
And that's the type of milk most Asian consumers are used to drinking, is that correct?
They are. I mean, for the fortunate ones that are able to spend the money on something such as milk that's highly nutritious, most imported milk into Asia comes from countries such as Australia and New Zealand in the form of UHT. So as we know it, it's a product that's processed at very high temperatures. It does take on a slightly different taste. And it's typically presented in a carton format. Where we're unique is that we're processing our fresh milk into plastic bottles. The plastic bottles enables us to design any shape that we like into different sizes. So we can customise a shape that might be better suited to a particular channel like Impulse, for example, or just better suited to a particular market that has certain design interests.
Milk isn't a new category for your company, so will this deal just be leveraging off your existing suppliers?
Yeah, so we've under our Rokeby Farms brand, for the last 2 years, we've been marketing a range of high-protein breakfast smoothies that we sell through the major grocers and convenience stores, which has been highly successful for us. So we've had great interest from Malaysia, from Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore and other markets to export our Rokeby Farms brand. So the Malaysian deal that we've got launching shortly really taps into that existing supply that we have from a collection of dairy farms located in Gippsland. So, we're hoping that obviously the increased demand can help launch. It's a great thing for Australian farmers and help them to launch overseas as well.
So are you dealing with milk suppliers directly or are you going through a processor?
So currently we go through a processor who collects the milk from us from a range of farms located in Gippsland. But with some of the export deals that we have coming up for the latter part of 2016, we will be going direct to farm.
Now this deal's worth $2 million. You've already said it's a really big milestone for your company. What are your broader ambitions beyond this in the export market?
Yeah, I think obviously this Malaysian deal is a real launching pad. It's given us the ability to invest into having more people in our business focus on export. So we have not only the ability to process long shelf life dairy, but also we have some very unique capability to extend the shelf life of juice. We've launched a range called Impressed, which is a cold pressed juice brand, which utilises high pressure processing as an alternative method to heat pasteurisation. And we've had a massive amount of interest in that range across Asia and through the Middle East as well. So we're hoping that this Malaysian export deal will help be a launching pad for our Impressed brand as well.
And we hear all the time from exporters that maintaining those relationships is really hard work and you wear out the shoe leather a fair bit. So are you expecting to clock up some frequent flyer miles in the next couple of years?
Yeah, I think we're not under any illusion it's going to be a challenge. We've found it challenging enough to build the business from scratch over 10 years just in our local market. Australia is a big market, so we have people located in Melbourne in our head office here and also teams in Sydney, Brisbane and Perth. So we are, I guess, well versed in having to travel around a big country. But yeah, we're not under any illusion. It's going to be a challenge. We're going to have to get across there. And as we have been doing over the last few months, we've been hosting a lot of inbound missions for various companies here. But it's also a matter of getting in front of people and really understanding the market, building those relationships and hopefully leveraging our great brands.
Made Beverages co-founder Luke Margette speaking there with Clint Jasper. A big thanks to Brendan O'Neill this morning for technical production. That's the program for this week. I'm Edwina Farley. Stay with us on RN.
Want to hear about the best party in town this election season? It's a new podcast with me, Frank Kelly.
And me, Patricia Carvelis.
The Party Room, your essential guide to this federal election. Subscribe now. Simply search for The Party Room in your podcast app.
Or listen via the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.